Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Not even 2 months had passed since Election Day in November when the race for Tom Tillis's U.S. Senate seat began. The senior senator announced his intention to run for re-election in December. That election won't happen until November 2026, but already Tillis has Republican challengers, and a Democrat has announced for 2026 with likely more to come. Lots of people will be watching Tom Tillis and this Senate race over the next 2 years. Donald Trump and the MAGA Nation will be watching to determine if Tillis is faithful enough to the movement to get their support. Tillis was censured in June of 2023 by the North Carolina Republican Party for making deals with Democrats on certain pieces of legislation, but just last week, though it looked as though he had reservations, he still voted to confirm Trump's pick of Pete Hegseth to be Secretary of Defense, while other GOP senators defected. And people will be watching because the outcome of this race, 2 years from now, may have the potential of changing the balance of power in the Senate. We're going to examine that, what it takes to win as a Republican in Washington, whether individuals can remain true to their personal principles or be compelled to abandon them to survive in Donald Trump's Washington, and more. We have several people here to help us through this discussion, but I'm going to begin with Reuben Jones. He's in the thick of it all covering Capitol Hill for Spectrum News One. He joins us now, but he has to leave early because he's also covering the Robert Kennedy hearing in the Senate Finance Committee this morning at 10 o'clock. And joining him is Mary Ellen McIntyre, a politics writer for CQ Roll Call, where she covers the House and Senate. Good morning to you both. Thank you for being here. Reuben, as I said, Tom Tillis declared in December for an election that will not take place until November of 2026. That seems early, is it?
Not in politics today. I've seen some projections that this race could cost $500 million or more, given just how there's very few chances for Democrats to actually pick up a Senate seat in 2026, and North Carolina is one of those. So it's not only going to be a tough general election fight, but he's potentially got a tough primary fight ahead of him, too.
Mary Ellen, talk about the role that Tom Tillis plays today in the United States Senate. How much power or influence does he have? And given that Ted Budd, the junior senator from North Carolina, was endorsed by Donald Trump, is he the one that is basking in the glow of greater favor?
You know, Tillis plays, I think, an interesting role in the Senate. He's certainly a faithful Republican voting for, you know, Pete Hegseth's nomination as Secretary of Defense. But he is in that group of senators that I think is a little bit more of a question mark on some of these nominees than someone like Senator Budd. He did vote for Hegseth. You know, he's on the Finance Committee today. He hasn't said too much about the RFK nomination yet. But an outside group backed by Democrats, Protect Our Care, is running an RFK group. They're running ads in North Carolina, urging Tillis, similarly to several other senators in their states, to vote against him. So he definitely sort of is in this key group. But Tillis, I think, sees himself as a deal maker and, you know, someone who's going to be pretty confident in how he goes about preparing for both a potential primary and the general election that's sure to be competitive.
Republicans in the House belong to Donald Trump almost 100%. In the Senate, perhaps because they have longer terms, six-year terms, they are traditionally more independent, but they too appear to be mostly in Trump's camp. That's normal in a normal presidency, particularly in the honeymoon phase, but this has already proven to be an abnormal presidency. Within hours of taking office, Trump pardoned more than 1,500 people and commuted the sentences of 14 others. Those people were involved in an attempt to thwart the outcome of the 2020 election, took part in an insurrection in which police officers were injured, attacked. Some died as a result of this. You spoke, Reuben, to Senator Tillis as he walked through the halls of the Capitol last week about what he thought about that decision.
Many of them probably was the right thing to do. They made a bad choice, but anybody who was convicted of assault on a police officer, I can't get there at all. I think it was a bad idea.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but he is one of the few Republican members of Congress who articulated a problem with these pardons. Did his outspokenness surprise you in the current environment there, Reuben?
Yeah, there were a few Republicans who spoke out about it, but not a lot. I'll tell you, Senator Ted Budd, the other senator from North Carolina, did not speak out about it. But did it surprise me? Not too much, because Tillis is a little bit more outspoken than some other Republicans. Maybe the fact that it got so much attention surprised me a little bit, given that what he said was not exactly a, perhaps would not have been a radical thought in 2021, when lots of Republicans, lots of Democrats were speaking out against what happened on January 6th and the violence that we saw. So I guess it's in a new look at what this Senate is today. But he certainly raised a lot of eyebrows from some.
And he's kind of walking a tightrope, which we'll talk about as we go through the hour here. Tom Tillis first went to the Senate by beating the late Senator Kay Hagan, a Democratic incumbent, in 2014. He won re-election against Cal Cunningham, another Democrat, obviously, in 2020. Cunningham's campaign was kind of compromised by a scandal that today would probably not be disqualifying, given all that's happened and has surrounded other candidates. He beat Hagan by 1.5%. He beat Cunningham by 1.8%. Tiny little margins. If he ends up being the Republican nominee in 2026, would he likely beat a Democrat again? Or will we have to wait to see what shakes out, Ruben, in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think it all depends on what happens in the next few years, and it depends on who the Democratic nominee is. Now, obviously, all of the rumors and speculation is around former Governor Roy Cooper and whether he will run. And if he runs as the Democrat, he is no doubt the favorite to win the Democratic primary and would obviously be a very tough challenge for Tom Tillis. Cooper has never lost an election, but Tillis has shown that he is hard to beat as well. So this general election could be fascinating to watch. As you say, Mike, he is walking a very tight rope, because anything he says or does gets attacked from more hard right Republicans, and it gets attacked from Democrats. I mean, all you have to do is go on his Twitter page, and anything he posts, he'll get attacked as a rhino. He'll get attacked as a hard right Republican, and so he's got a tough position, and it's going to be a difficult 2 years for him.
Mary Ellen, you're the one that mentioned that he's known for reaching across the aisle to work with the other party, and that's gotten him into trouble. In 2022, he voted to protect interracial and same-sex marriages under federal law, which was the opposite of what he did in the North Carolina General Assembly when he was Speaker of the House. It's also something that is likely to run counter to some of the objectives of Project 2025, if that is the playbook being used by the White House. In 2023, the state GOP censured him for violating the party's platform on positions like LGBTQ+ legislation and gun laws after he worked the previous year in 2022 with Democratic Senator Chris Murphy on the largest piece of gun reform legislation in 30 years. Tillis has cast himself as a pragmatist, although some Trump supporters, as Ruben just said, criticize him because he's a rhino, but he's voted with Donald Trump 90% of the time in office. So how should we view Tom Tillis? Is he a conservative? Is he a pragmatist? Is he an outlier in his party?
I think he's more of a pragmatist than a conservative. And you need to remember, when you're in the Senate, it's sort of a chamber that is designed to facilitate, in theory, bipartisan work. So in the last several years, you know, we had divided government. For members like Tillis who want to accomplish something, they sort of had to look to working with Democrats, particularly if legislation was going to be signed into law. So that's sort of something that, you know, senators from these competitive states like North Carolina really have to sort of strike the balance on, of your constituents want to see you working. They want to see you reaching across the aisle. You are in, you know, like you said, he, you know, is winning by fewer than 2 percentage points in his most recent reelection. You've got to kind of court those Democratic voters as well as your Republican base. It's a hard line to walk that he's doing here. And like Ruben said, you know, there are very few senators initially this cycle who are in competitive states. I think, you know, there's sort of five initially that are in what we kind of at this point expect to be the battleground states. And so that puts a real big spotlight on those senators in a way that, you know, if you had more senators up for re-election in competitive states, it sort of spreads things out a little bit.
There are several tests of MAGA fealty coming down the pike last week and this week as the Trump nominations for cabinet positions have hearings in the Senate. Tillis did express, Ruben, some reservations about Pete Hegseth to be Secretary of Defense, although he ended up winning the nomination. Only Mitch McConnell, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski voted against that nomination. Mitch doesn't have a lot to lose. He's kind of been freed up by not being the majority leader. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, we'll see what happens to them. Although there was a rumor at one point that I heard, and you can verify it or not, that Tillis was trying to convince some senators to vote against Hegseth. Any validity to that rumor at all from what you've heard in the halls of Congress?
Well, there's some good reporting from Politico. I think it came out yesterday talking about how basically the White House put this pressure campaign on Tillis to try and make sure that he voted for Hegseth. And then the outside from sort of the MAGA world also tried to attack him as a rhino and threatening a primary against him. And so you have to wonder how much of the criticism he faces from the MAGA world, if you will, is from within Trump's own orbit and people just trying to pressure him a lot. So, I mean, look, a lot of what Tillis did on Hegseth was sort of behind the scenes, and it didn't really come out until the very last minute. And it was thought that he was going to vote for Hegseth up until the last minute. And then he issued that statement that said he would, in fact, vote for him. So I was not very surprised that he voted for Hegseth, given some what I've seen from Tillis in the past. I will say he's a question mark for Robert F. Kennedy, whose confirmation hearings start today. I spoke with Tillis about him just a week or two ago about RFK, and he said, I need to hear more from Hegseth. He needs to do well in his confirmation hearing. He's concerned about his views on vaccines.
Yesterday, Caroline Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s cousin, who's known him for her entire life, wrote a scathing letter to every member of Congress about this appointment to Secretary of Health and Human Services. I think that's what he's up for today. What impact, Mary Ellen, do you think that letter will have on anybody on the Finance Committee that is hearing that today, or the other committee, which I believe is hearing it tomorrow?
You know, I certainly think that this is something that Democrats in particular on these two hearings will bring up. The question of how much influence it has, whether it sways anyone who was, you know, is, I think, an open question. I think there are a lot of different things that could sway senators here. He's a somewhat unconventional choice for Secretary of Health and Human Services, I would say. I was a former health reporter. He's not like, you know, Alex Azar, Trump's previous health secretary, or Tom Price, his first health secretary in his first administration. So it's an interesting choice. You know, I certainly expect that letter has some, you know, rather strange allegations in it, you know, but I don't know if it'll really be that one particular letter or, you know, sort of some of these general stories that we've heard about RFK's history that, you know, come together if any Republicans do decide to vote against him.
So Senator Tillis sits on two of the committees that I think are reviewing Robert Kennedy's nomination, and that is the Finance Committee, which meets this morning at 10 o'clock, and the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. They will hold their hearings on Thursday. He voted to confirm Pete Hegseth. He announced his support for Scott Bessent to be Secretary of the Treasury. What has he said about Pam Bondi or Kash Patel for FBI and for Attorney General in reverse order there? I have 30 seconds, Ruben.
I believe he is supporting Kash Patel. I do not know what he has said about Tulsi Gabbard. I will say that there is reporting that former Senator, North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, is introducing Tulsi Gabbard at her confirmation hearing, which could play into Tillis's thoughts on her.
We have to take a break. We have to let Ruben go to that Finance Committee hearing. And when we come back, we'll introduce some more people who will dissect the 2026 senatorial race in North Carolina. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. Charlottetalks.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the 2026 Senate race in North Carolina. Tom Tillis up for re-election. There are a lot of variables at play with more that we can't even anticipate in the next couple of years. But to help us broaden this discussion on the tightrope that is being walked by Senator Tillis and what it's like to be a Republican in Donald Trump's Washington, we're joined now by Susan Roberts. She is a professor of political science at Davidson College, a frequent guest on the program. Welcome back. And Donna King is editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal, a publication of the John Locke Foundation. That's a nonprofit North Carolina think tank. And Mary Ellen McIntyre stays with us. She's a politics writer covering the House and Senate for CQ Roll Call. Thank you all for joining us. Before I move on to other guests, Mary Ellen, one more question that I tried to sneak in the last segment, but I'll do it now. Republicans hold 53 seats in the Senate. Democrats hold 45. There are two independents who generally caucus with and vote with Democrats. Some believe that the outcome of the North Carolina Senate race in 2 years could play a role in changing the makeup of the Senate. Is that likely or is it too early to tell? Unmute yourself, Mary Ellen.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Democrats have a pretty tough math in 2026. There are only two states with Republican incumbents that sort of start off as battlegrounds. It's North Carolina with Senator Tillis and Maine with Senator Collins. So if they flip both of those states, that would obviously not bring them to a majority. So it would bring them, you know, a tighter majority, but Republicans would remain in the majority. So that sort of requires them to go into some of these other red states. Texas is one that I think comes to mind as sort of the next example of a state that Democrats have been trying to flip for the last several cycles and have been unsuccessful. But, you know, it's very early. Things can certainly change. We did see in the first midterms in Trump's first term, Democrats had a great year. So we'll see what happens if there are states that sort of become more competitive for Democrats. But sort of initially, it's going to be a pretty tough upward climb for them to win back majority in 2 years.
So Donna King, before I broaden this discussion out beyond just the Tom Tillis race, talk about, for a moment if you can, the two Republicans who have also already thrown their hat into the ring for 2026. I know none of us seems to know much about Brooks Agnew, but talk about Andy Nilsen. Who is he?
Sure. So Andy Nilsen is a football coach. He's a gentleman from the Greensboro area. He has thrown his hat in the ring. His history is an interesting point that might be difficult to win over really broad Republican-based support. One of them is that he tried to start a organization, a convention in North Carolina that was not Trump, not pro-Trump. They called it National Republicans. And he formed it after sort of the Reagan-Bush era Republican and did that with former Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr. So, you know, being non-Trump and kind of associating, aligning with Bob Orr is not going to sit well with that base Republican group in North Carolina. And that said, now he has said, hey, look, I'm all for Trump. I'm for Trump's priorities. So he's going to have some difficulty winning that crowd back.
So what happened? Because as you say, he joined with Bob Orr, who actively worked to make sure that Donald Trump had something to run up against with Republicans. He tried to minimize support of Republicans for the re-election of Donald Trump. He tried to organize a alternative Republican convention. Andy Nilsen has said that he's been working for years, since 2019, in preserving the Reagan-Bush legacy of the GOP against the Trump takeover. Now he's all in for Trump. He says he's running against Tom Tillis because he doesn't believe Tillis can be relied upon to fully support Trump's America First agenda. Is he a flip-flopper? Is he spineless? Is he an opportunist? Or did he have some sort of genuine epiphany on the road to Damascus?
I mean, you know, your guess is as good as mine on that one. Now his Twitter profile has a MAGA hat. He's wearing a MAGA hat in his Twitter profile. He may be just reading the tea leaves of what's happening in what happened in 2024 for North Carolina Republicans. I think that it's going to be a challenge to certainly win over that crowd. I think that there's been some word on perhaps Laura Trump coming in for a primary for him. Perhaps that would be, you know, something that would really be a problem for Tom Tillis. But I think that people underestimate Tillis at their peril. He really has proven himself over the years to be an incredibly effective House Speaker in North Carolina, and then go on to be a very pragmatic, senator. And I've worked with him. I was the policy director for Edgar Starnes when he was the majority leader. I know how Tillis works. He does interviews. He does his homework. He does his studying. So, you know, that is why you're going to see him 90% with Trump. That 10% gets a lot of headlines.
Susan, what's your take on Mr. Nielsen, who has made this complete flip-flop change from anti-Trump to all in for Trump? Either he's rolled over like many people in Congress, because as Donna said, he's read the tea leaves. But if you read the tea leaves, this sounds like a very Neville Chamberlain moment here.
Well, political science once, scientists said, members of Congress are single-minded seekers of re-election. And I think that sums it up. I want to mention two things that opposition research on Tillis, one that have to dig for, the other they could find. And the one they have to, they can't, it's not really talked about, and I mentioned it in my politics reproduction class, is Tillis really spearheaded some legislation, reparations for women who were victims of sterilization. And we were the first, North Carolina was the first in the country to do that. That's something that I don't think, excuse me, would sit with the MAGA crowd. And the second is, which I think incurred a lot of wrath, and I wrote down a couple of quotes because I wanted to get it right, I mentioned in my presidency class, is the editorial he wrote in the Washington Post in 2019. And he talked about he supported the wall, but he did not support Trump's use of the emergency power to pay for the wall. And if you'll just indulge me in this quote, he said he wanted to preserve the separation of powers and to curb the kind of executive overreach that Congress has allowed to take place for the better part of the last century. And he added, I am a member of the Senate, and I have grave concerns over when our institution looks the other way and wants to weaken and break Congress. I just think that that says a lot. And he has reached across the aisle. These are his words, and that is his action. And well, Donna is right. He made a really quick, very, very effective politician to Speaker of the House.
There's policy and there's process. And there's also a belief among some that Donald Trump's whole goal here is to break the government. Yesterday, he offered them, all government employees, a payout, essentially. It's a very corporate world kind of thing. Leave now and we'll give you 8 months of salary. Don't leave and we can't promise that you'll have a job, that kind of thing. There's that. And there's this idea of compromise being a dirty word. Our system is based on compromise. Democracy is based on compromise. If you can't compromise, nothing gets done. And when nothing gets done, that angers voters. But if you compromise now, there's a wing of the Republican Party that gets angry because you compromise, which puts the Senate, members of the Senate, members of the House, in terrible positions. Is there a way to break this, Susan?
I'm not sure there is a way to break it. I think right now, if you want to go continue with the C word instead of compromise, it's chaos. And Trump has a flair for the dramatic. It's in the dark of night, ICE, the Friday night firings. And I think that people underestimate what used to be. They say, oh, we still have the guardrails. I think the guardrails may be very threatened. And I think people have to understand that. I think democracy, and it was quote unquote on the ballot, is something that one understanding of democracy may be different from another's understanding of democracy.
I think, Donna, the guardrails, it could be argued successfully that the guardrails are gone, and that if Donald Trump continues along the line that he's demonstrated in the first week of being back at the White House, there he's obliterating the guardrails and putting operatives in place that will do his bidding. Those who voted for Trump are clearly frustrated with the system. They voted for somebody who promised to and is now disrupting the system. But it appears that a lot of the moves that he is making smack of authoritarian control. At worst, you're either with him or you're against him. And at best, he's someone willing to throw off, well, a lot of stuff against the wall to see what sticks. Either way, it's unconventional and often flies in the face of democracy. Are Americans tired of democracy?
Absolutely. I mean, we're a republic first, but I think that the important point is
we're a
that
democratic. Let's not split hairs here. We're a democratic republic.
Right. And I think what we're seeing a lot from the Trump administration is that effort to go back to smaller government, downsizing, responsibility. And I go back to actually eugenics that the professor was just talking about, which was an issue that Tom Tillis championed in the North Carolina House. That's a perfect example, actually, because that was forced sterilization by the government. I think what we're seeing is an example of that. There were a lot of Republicans that really supported this movement. And that is exactly what we're seeing again here in Congress, and what we're seeing coming from the White House is this idea that people are tired of feeling subservient to the government, whether it's the state government or the Department of Health and Human Services or the White House in this case, in all of these government agencies. So I think what we're seeing really is exactly what Trump voters wanted to see from him when they're coming in. And this constant drumbeat of activities, this goal to be first 30 days, first day in office, and having all of these executive actions, 200 actions in the first day, that's what they wanted to see. The issue, though, is because we're drowning now in all of these actions, we aren't getting a chance to really do the homework and get in there. And I think that's one thing we're going to see, I think, from Tillis and things like this. He's going to get those headlines. The Wall Street Journal article talking about this Hegseth thing, when you read what he did, he said he interviewed 38 people. I'm not sure that the base really sees the deliberative process that has to go into implementing some of these orders. They may have on the surface exactly what they want to see from the president, but there's going to be a lot more work to be done.
But I want to go back to the question, are Americans tired of democracy? Are they tired of it? Is it
absolutely
over?
Absolutely not. No, I don't think so at all. I think they want to see more of it. I think they want to see a reduction in the amount of policy made by bureaucrats over elected officials, things like that.
But Susan, Peter Thiel, who's largely responsible for J.D. Vance's political career, has said he doesn't believe in democracy. He doesn't think it works. J.D. Vance has also quoted another person whose name slips my mind at the moment, kind of a mentor in terms of political philosophy, who says that it's time for a CEO, and a CEO is a dictator, and Americans need to get over their phobia over dictators. The oligarchy seems to be in charge. Is this where we're headed?
Well, I think you're right to say oligarchy, and here's a nerd alert. Aristotle, when he talked about democracy, that was ruled by the many for personal good. Polity of what is what he wanted, and he wanted to make sure that oligarchy ruled by the rich for the good of the few was different from aristocracy, which is ruled by the few and the wise. And so I think that if you look at that, a democracy, and that's why, as you guys talked about, a democratic republic, I think it's very dangerous. And I think that one of the things that protects democracy is people knowing what's going on. And you see on the headlines on the news, the first 100 days. Well, whitehouse.gov has the first 100 hours. And I think that really indicates what's going on. First 100 hours.
Well, he promised to do a lot of things on his first day in office, and he came through. Mary Ellen, talk to me about what, if any of this that we've just been talking about, is being bandied about behind the scenes in the halls of Congress. Are there people talking about the end of small-r republicanism in the United States and a move toward a more central authoritarian figure, because Donald Trump is trying to minimize Congress?
You know, I don't think so. I think that Republicans in Congress right now are really focused on trying to start enacting his agenda. You know, they feel as if voters gave Republicans, both Trump and members of Congress, a mandate, as, you know, Donna was saying, to go in there to, you know, limit the bureaucracy, cut taxes, get this reconciliation bill that everyone's talking about moving, for Republican senators to confirm his nominees, to confirm his cabinet. They really feel moving ahead on that. And I think they feel more that, you know, Republican voters gave them a mandate. You know, I can tell you in the House, a lot of Republicans really feel as if, you know, the message was Democrats are going to win the House, and they feel like they sort of pushed back and won. And they are, you know, full steam ahead on enacting the president's agenda, yes, but also their agenda.
I think it can be successfully argued that the people who voted for Donald Trump did in fact give him a mandate to do much of what he's doing right now. But his margin of victory was very slim. He does not have a vast majority of Americans behind him. Is he walking a tightrope if he is successful in doing some of the unusual things that he has been in trying to accomplish here, Mary Ellen? Does he run the risk of losing the Congress in 2 years?
I think in general, any president runs the risk of losing the Congress in 2 years. The House majority is very, very narrow. It's even more narrow than it was the last 2 years. You know, we have fewer and fewer, it feels like, you know, compared to many decades ago, of actually competitive House races due to gerrymandering, political realignments, things like that. You're in a very few seats. So it's going to be a very, very competitive midterm cycle for the House. Certainly Republicans have a chance to lose it. I will say, I think they start out feeling confident, but we'll see. I think that, you know, their success in whether or not they're able to enact Trump's agenda and actually, you know, pass some laws is going to be really telling.
And Susan, we're talking like about this in ways that we would have talked about this during the Reagan years or the Bush years or the Clinton years, where there were disagreements over policy. But fundamentally, there was an agreement that the United States is the Democratic Republic, and that the voters make a difference, and that the people in Washington allegedly work for us. We may not agree on everything, but we do agree that the United States is what it is. That seems to be in question today, and we're talking about it as though what's going on today is equivalent to what happened when Reagan came into office, or when FDR came into office, for that matter. Is it?
Well, I think what we're forgetting, many people are, this is a representative democracy. And these people that gave Trump the quote-unquote mandate have to go back, the members of Congress have to go back and answer to their constituents. Gerrymandering, as Mary Ellen pointed out, is real. And it's made for less than 30 competitive seats every election cycle for the House. But some of these programs have an impact on people, whether it's red or blue, when you're looking at Head Start and all these other programs. And I think that if I were to do this, I would reframe the whole issue instead of saying, and the first 108 hours says golden age. Why not reframe it in terms of restoring the American dream, something that everybody can connect with, even if people understand that, different interpretations, but phrasing it as the golden age, I think constituency responsibility, and these are things that we're going to have to look at. Members of Congress are going to have to say, my constituents, what happens?
Susan Roberts is with us, Davidson College professor of political science, Donna King, editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal, and Mary Ellen McIntyre writes for CQ and Roll Call. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins here with Mary Ellen McIntyre, politics writer for the House and Senate for CQ Roll Call, Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, and Donna King, editor-in-chief for the Carolina Journal, a publication of the John Locke Foundation. I was talking prior to the break about whether or not this is normal, whether we should be talking about what's happening here as normal. It is certainly a political realignment, a philosophical realignment, and perhaps a move away from the neoliberalism of the New Deal, because I think Donald Trump at one point said he's going to dismantle the New Deal. And you can take with that for what you will. You can like it or not. One of the things that he did in the first day that shocked a lot of people was the use of the presidential pardon. That pardon power resides in the Constitution. He had a right to do what he did. Trump's pardon of the January 6th insurrectionists, however, struck some Republicans as specious. Spectrum News One's Reuben Jones, who was with us earlier in the program, followed up with the question we played the response to a moment ago from Tom Tillis about the specific pardon and President Biden's pardons moments before he left office with a question about whether Congress should review that pardon power. In a stairwell at the Capitol, here's what Tom Tillis said.
I think it's a legit question because we can't get into this cycle where presidents are, you know, pardoning their friends, creating prospective pardons for for charges that haven't even been applied. I don't think that that's what the founding fathers had in mind when this ability to pardon was first vested in the executive branch.
And this weekend, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said that if these excessive, these are his words, excessive pardons continue, Congress may have to revisit these powers. And he added this when he spoke with Kristen Welker on NBC's Meet the Press.
Do you believe that President Trump was wrong to issue these blanket pardons to the January 6th defendants?
Number one, he had the legal authority to do it, but I fear that you will get more violence. Pardoning the people who went into the Capitol and beat up a police officer violently, I think was a mistake because it seems to suggest that's an okay thing to do.
So he spoke about revisiting the pardon power of the presidency. Susan, how? I mean, this is in the Constitution. Are they proposing a constitutional amendment?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, that's what they'd have to do. And I think that, I think looking at these pardons, I don't look back and see, to me right now, that the focus is not going to be on what Biden did. But Bill Clinton pardoned some of his friends and people that were involved in some scandals that occurred in his administration. I think
is that equivalent? Stop right there. They're trying to make the pardons that Biden did of his family and others equivalent to pardons of 1,500 people who attacked the United States government.
They are not equivalent. And I think that, you know, what people have pointed out, A, they're not equivalent, and I didn't mean to imply that, but B, something I didn't know is that there's a high likelihood of recidivism with these pardons, these people committing more crimes.
Yeah.
That only have heard, I don't know that for a fact. And I think that's dangerous too.
While the Congress may want to try and change the Constitution when it comes to pardon power, Trump wants to change the 14th Amendment when it comes to eliminating birthright citizenship. And although one prays he was joking because it would lead to a constitutional crisis, he did allude this week to another change he would like to make.
I've raised a lot of money for the next race that I assume I can't use for myself, but I'm not 100% sure because I don't know. I think I'm not allowed to run again. I'm not sure. Am I allowed to run again, Mike? I better not get you involved in that argument.
The Mike he was referring to, of course, is Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, who appears wholly in the Trump camp. Donna, this isn't the first time that Donald Trump or others have raised the specter of a third Donald Trump term. If the MAGA wing holds sway over the next 4 years, do you see them altering the Constitution to allow for a third term, or will he simply throw his hat into the ring, run again, and be elected?
Well, I think that, of course, this would have to go through Congress, and that's the big question.
Congress rolls over and doesn't do take and makes no objections to some of the things that he wants to do and has already tried to do, this is just another thing. Wouldn't they just roll over and say, hey, leader, take over, baby?
I think it still would have to go through Congress. They would still have to. To amend the Constitution, they would still have to go through Congress.
The point I'm getting at here is he's trying to do things. He's already done things that are illegal. You cannot do some of the things that he did. But if nobody stands up against it, they will happen. And it looks like the Congress, at least the Republican side of the aisle, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House. We have three branches of government, but not really anymore. So if he wants to run again, who's to stop him?
Sure. I mean, he certainly can throw his hat in the ring, and he can also run under a different party if he wants to. So, you know, those are all of those things that could certainly happen. But I think what we're also saying is there's some premises in your initial statement that, make the assumption that, one, Congress would roll over. And I think that would be highly unlikely that they would, because it is such a narrow majority. And we're talking about midterms.
Why would it be unlikely when the entire House is in the Trump camp? Why? Why would it be unlikely if senators are fearful of bucking Donald Trump by saying anything that might get him angry? Why is it unlikely?
The example that I would give then goes back to our initial discussion on Tillis. Just nominating and confirming Pete Hegseth came down to one vote. The idea that the entire Congress would roll over is just unlikely. And we're also talking about a very narrow majority. and a midterm that doesn't reflect well for historically for the incumbent president. So I think that that makes a lot of assumptions that we just would not see materialize. And I think also the Trump administration right now is, as the professor said, very focused on the first 100 hours, first 100 days. I think that they are seeing that midterm as tomorrow's problem.
So let me get your take on that, Susan, because Donna said that, yes, maybe Trump could run again as a candidate for another party, indicating that perhaps Republicans would object to him running again because it would be unconstitutional for him to do so. But it would be unconstitutional for him to run again as a third party candidate and to take office as a third party candidate or any party candidate because it's against the Constitution. But we have a Congress that has become, as I said, a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House. We have two branches that seem to be in the bag.
Well, I think that this is the MO of Donald Trump. Action, consequences be darned, and lawsuits. You know, we'll figure it out. They'll sue us. We'll sue back. I think that at some point, when you look at things like the separation of powers, and I just call it the mirror test, Republicans looking themselves in the mirror in the morning may say, "Ooh, I don't think this is constitutional," or "Ooh, this is a bridge too far." And I'm an institutionalist. I still think that was Tom Tillis being coy? I don't know. Was he being considered and deliberative? I don't know. I mean, but I think to wholly dismiss some members like that, and I, you know, there's a generation of older folks like myself that remember when members of Congress did deliberate. And I hate to think that is over, but you look at some of the things that have changed politics forever, social media, I can't make predictions.
I know, Mary Ellen, you want to comment on this, but I want to add, you can feel free to do that, but I want to add a question. Why run for Congress if you're just going to be a rubber stamp for the White House? If you're afraid to take a position, legitimately afraid or not, in opposition to the White House, why not just stay home?
Yeah, I'll get to that. I think that's something that's in this conversation is really notable is that the House, the makeup of Republicans in the House are far more pro-Trump now in his second term than it was in 2017 when he first took office. He was new. A lot of people who, you know, were sort of in that like never Trump wing of the Republican Party were either voted out of the House or resigned. And the Republicans, even from moderate districts who have run for the House, are more openly pro-Trump than the moderates of that Congress. I think in the Senate, you have, you know, more members who are not necessarily joining Congress since Trump, you know, has been in office and are a little bit more, have a little bit more space from him. I mean, you had 10 members, several of which I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, who did vote to impeach him, who are still in office. Now, some of those members, Bill Cassidy, for example, is going to be up for re-election next year as well. So we'll see how that, you know, how those votes come to fare for them. But, you know, I think people are still really interested in running for Congress. You had a lot of Republicans step forward last year, eager to run on the same ballot as President Trump.
Why? If you're not going to have your own policy proposals, if you're not going to stand up for your own personal principles, whatever they may be, because you're afraid that you'll be primaried by the MAGA wing of the Republican Party or whatever you're afraid of, why bother?
I think that for a lot of candidates who are stepping forward, they do feel like they, you know, agree with President Trump and that his vision for the country is the way to go.
Okay. Donna, you wanted to comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did, actually. I think that one of the things is, you know, terms like rubber stamp and that you can't have your own policies. These are their policies. I think that's an important point to make. You know, this base of the Republican Party that really supported Donald Trump, won the popular vote. They are putting candidates and they are putting elected leaders and Republicans in Congress in this case that do support that agenda. So this is their agenda. And certainly, I think we're seeing a lot of things behind the scenes, of course, that they have their own priorities, particularly for their districts. But I don't think that they are afraid of the White House to the degree that it means that they aren't putting forward their proposal ideas. They support this agenda.
Well, let me flip the script just a little bit, Donna. Trump has used his fifth grade playground bully name calling taunts to imitate or intimidate a lot of different people, everyone who doesn't agree with him, actually. That is a departure from past leaders. Recently, the White House warned of consequences For Republicans who don't support all of Donald Trump's nominees, a senior White House advisor told NBC News, quote, it's pass-fail. You either support everyone or you don't. The Senate needs to advise and consent, not advise and adjust. That sounds thuggish, but is it? Isn't it reminiscent of the arm twisting that LBJ used to do behind the scenes?
I think it's transparent. I mean, certainly, I think we've seen it in all levels. We've seen it in North Carolina from the governor. We've seen it in the White House with Congress. I think it's transparent. I think we're just getting a look behind the scenes. And a lot of that is because of social media. Individual voters have an access like no other generation has to what's going on behind the scenes. So I don't think it's new. I think it's just we're seeing it more often.
So let me get back, Susan, to that comment from the White House. The Senate needs to advise and consent, which is in the Constitution. It's a phrase from the Constitution, and not advise and adjust. But constitutionally, isn't the role of the Senate to provide feedback to a president on their nominations and then to reject them if they feel that somebody is not qualified or somehow wrong for the job? Isn't that the process?
Well, I think when the if you look at the Federalist Papers, which explain the reasoning of the founders, they did think it was the role of the Senate to, look at treaties, to look at nominees. But there is disagreement about how much do you advise and how if you should consent. And so that's, I think that that's debatable. And I think that if you look at some of the nominees, what used to be, extraordinary, Zoe Bard with, I think it was Obama. She had an illegal, an immigrant child care giver, and that was enough to sink hers. So we've become much more tolerant of what we can see and look for in a nominee. I think it's, he can look at that and it can say, you should consent more than advise.
There are cabinet nominees whose backgrounds have raised security concerns, particularly when juxtaposed with the agencies that they might end up running, Mary Ellen. And one senator speaking anonymously to NBC said, we'll only give so much because this is the future of the country. It is not entertainment television. But that's how Donald Trump runs his White House, as though it were a reality show. He learned a lot from The Apprentice about promotion and how to focus your attention, etc. If senators are concerned, are they abdicating their responsibility by maintaining this loyalty, this unquestioning loyalty to Trump, allowing these nominees through, or are they simply not as dangerous as some would portray them as being?
I think with some of these things, Trump, it's not like Trump is doing anything that should be a surprise to anyone. He's pushing through the kinds of folks that he said he wanted to push through to shake up the government. And I think there's sort of been always a bit of a default of if this is the team the president wants, unless there's, a glaring reason not to. The Senate has historically confirmed these nominees many times in the past on a bipartisan basis. We're sort of moving further away from that as the years go on, as we're seeing in some of these. But, you have seen some Democratic support for several of these nominees. And I'm so sorry. Your exact question is sort of just slipping my mind.
That's okay. The question was, should the Senate say no to people that they legitimately think are dangerous for the country in the jobs that they're being appointed to, or is it the case that these people really aren't as dangerous as some would position them as being?
I think for a lot of Republicans, they don't necessarily view these nominees as dangerous. They view them as people who are going to shake up government. And so that's why they're voting to confirm them. And if a senator does feel as if, a nominee is dangerous, and probably they shouldn't vote to confirm them. But that's something that each individual senator, goes through their individual processes.
Donna, I know you wanted to comment on it. I only have 1 minute left, and I want to bring this back to Tom Tillis and the John Locke Foundation, because there are other GOP candidates likely to emerge, including Laura Bush, to challenge Tom Tillis in 2 years. But Andy Jackson with the John Locke Foundation's Civitas Center for Public Integrity warns that replacing Tillis, a moderate and an incumbent, with a grassroots favorite who is more MAGA could cause the GOP to lose a seat to a Democrat in a purple state like North Carolina. I literally have 30 seconds. Do you agree?
I would agree, actually, because I think that One of the things we're seeing is the potential of Governor Roy Cooper jumping in. We're already seeing, I'm expecting in the next 30 to 60 days, something from Wiley Nickel. The North Carolina Democrats have three fairly strong likely candidates there that they really need to think about, because we have a 30% threshold for our primaries. You used to have 40. And that means that you end up with those primary voters really having say over who is the ultimate candidate in the general.
Donna King is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Mary Ellen McIntyre with CQ Roll Call, and Susan Robertson, Roberts at Davidson College. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.